Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks for the chance to speak, and thanks everyone for showing up, even though I have observing in my title. So this is going to be a lot less formal, undoubtedly, than a lot of the talks so far, but I think it's not totally crazy, because what I secretly want my title to be is actually not this, but Observing Fundamental Aspects. Of superstring theory. And at least that might have drawn a big audience or hecklers, but I think it's not totally crazy, and probably you know the reason it's not totally crazy. There are already sort of a class of, or you know, a group of potential observables in cosmology that at least have benefited strongly from string theory, and in some situations could potentially even truly honestly test fundamental aspects. So of course, there are things like cosmic strings. There's a lot of interest recently in primordial gravitational waves. And the third thing, which I'm going to talk about clearly, is primordial non-Gaussianity. And you know, this has sort of been going on for a long time. This you might have heard a little bit about if you were here 3 or 4 weeks ago. And this, I think, is particularly interesting just because it's really rich. And so let me explain that by first of all just explaining, of course, non-Gaussianity essentially means interaction. So usually we describe inflation by the simplest thing that gives the right equation of state for an accelerating expansion in the early universe, which is just a single scalar field. But of course we know that that scalar field isn't exactly free. At a very minimum, it's coupled to gravity. And so it's interesting to start asking about interactions, which could of course be gravitational. There could be, there's usually, as we imagine it, some potential for this field besides just a mass term. So there are often self-interactions. Sorry, I have a habit of writing small, so I'll try to be bigger. And also, of course, even though a single field is the simplest thing, there can be interactions with other fields. There could be multiple fields here. And the point is that by looking at details of the interactions that we see, we can actually try to distinguish between this kind of physics. So this is really the goal of moving inflation from this sort of, you know, semi-qualitative picture where sort of like, you know, the Higgs or dark matter or something. We have an idea that the phenomena is there, but you know, we haven't yet actually seen the particles produced in the lab. So we really want to move it from something like this to something where we understand the fundamental picture. And this is great, right? Because from the string theory or high energy point of view, this is something that most likely took place at an energy that's higher than all of the current collider energies. So the best thing we know, you know, is essentially that there's some scale H, which is below, you know, who knows what else, but probably the string scale, certainly the Planck scale. And we know that this is at least, you know, it can be bigger than about 10 to the 13 GeV, or we would already see evidence of this in primordial gravitational waves. But we also think that it, you know, must be bigger than, certainly larger than the scale where nucleosynthesis happens, and probably even a bit larger than that, maybe. So somewhere in this range. So there's a good bet that this is higher than anything LHC can see. So if we can actually probe interactions there, we're getting very fundamental physics. And the reason that we can actually talk about observing this in cosmology is really because literally we have observations now. The potential was already there for things like WMAP to actually see evidence of this. It didn't so far, but we have, as you probably know, in 6 days, I think, the successor to WMAP will launch, which is the Planck satellite. And between Planck and, you know, maybe the next 10 years, so I think this is really a time scale on the order of LHC, there's a potential there to discover all kinds of interesting things. So we also have large-scale structure surveys. And by this I just mean basically counts of the number and redshift of galaxies and galaxy clusters. So this sort of fills in a huge, huge data set that we don't have too much of yet, that we're getting at the moment, and that we'll continue to get over the next decade. And basically, you know, the reason that we care about all of this stuff is that when we write down a theory of inflation, we write down something for the scalar field phi and its fluctuations. But we know that although we're not, you know, exactly sure that this field is there and what that field is, we do see evidence of primordial curvature fluctuations. Some point after inflation, and the familiar place to see that is in the cosmic microwave background. So we certainly see temperature fluctuations, which is a good evidence of this. And we think that all of that stuff, you know, evolved with physics that we pretty much know and turned into the galaxies and galaxy clusters. So if we predict statistics for this guy, of course, we pretty much know the physics to carry it through and predict interesting physics for the rest of this. And that's really the thing that hasn't been done too much yet for a variety of reasons. And we don't quite have the data yet to really see what there is to see, but that's going to happen in the next 10 years. Okay. All right. So I'm going to introduce, again, just finish my intro with a little bit of notation. And since I'm not sure exactly how much cosmology most people are familiar with, please let me know if either I'm not telling you something really important or I'm telling you something everybody knows. So the thing I need to introduce is first of all, just this parameter that you usually hear quoted when people talk about non-Gaussianity, which is this FNL, this F nonlinear. And the way this came about was sort of cosmologists thinking generically, what's a nice way that I could incorporate non-Gaussianity into my theory? And it turned out to be a really useful way in terms of observations and a variety of things. And what they did was they said, well, let's just suppose that whatever the real space curvature field is, we know it's essentially a Gaussian, we think. And the easiest way to get something non-Gaussian out of a Gaussian is just this, the square of the field with some parameter, which is this nonlinear parameter. And just keep the mean zero. And so this was Salopek and Bond. It's what's used in the WMAP analysis for a long time and still now. So this is Komatsu and Spergel. And this thing goes by the name of the local ansatz. So you can see right away that this is nice, right? Because once I write this down, I'm able to calculate any correlation functions that I want. And the ones that we usually care about are, of course, the power spectrum. And roughly this, the only important features here are, first of all, that it doesn't matter where you take the points on the sky, what their orientation is. So there's a delta function, there's some scaling, and then there's this thing which basically quantifies the two numbers that we really know about inflation, which is the amplitude of fluctuations. And if there's any sort of residual scale dependence here. So basically what we know is that this is a number of order 10 to the minus 9, and this is something that's slightly less than 1. And that's it. You can go further with this, of course, and calculate the 3-point. And so let me write it down just so that you see, again, sort of the important features. So again, there's going to be a delta function.
So just for clarity, right now you know that around which base of K-naught and for how many decades in K?
What's that?
For right now you know those numbers for around which K-naught and for how many decades
yeah,
in K?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So basically what I should do and what maybe I can do now is illustrate the fact that, so if I write the potential for the inflaton, we think that sort of under the typical Stoll rule, there's some really flat part and maybe, you know, some place where inflation ends. And usually the part that we see is sort of back toward the beginning. It's these large scales. So there's some little region on the potential here, which usually determines K-naught. And this is on order of some, you know, hundredths, thousandths of inverse megaparsecs in practice. And we really just see a few E-folds around here. You have some physics that you think constrains what happens on really small scales, so you don't want to get too many primordial black holes or whatever. But for the most part, what we can observe is actually a really small region, and that's an important point. The other important point, so because of that, essentially what cosmologists have sometimes done in practice is sort of Taylor expand around this point. And that sounds good if you want to match what you can observe, but that's not so great to match this feature that you actually need to have inflation last a lot longer than this region that you can actually observe.
So how much does it rise when you include the galaxy?
Yeah, not too much, because it basically only goes down to K of 1. So it's really only, you know, short distance more, few
E-folds. If it goes
to
meter works, you'd get a lot more?
Yeah, definitely. I actually don't know what the total K range of that is. But so the part of the hope, which is part of what I'm going to get to, is that we can actually find ways of observing stuff that pushes us this way. So you remember during inflation that essentially the inflaton acts as a clock. Modes freeze out when they reach the size of the horizon. And because the horizon over AH is shrinking, essentially you have large-scale modes corresponding to earlier in inflation and small-scale modes corresponding to later. So when you see something that has, you know, for example, the scale dependence here, what you're really seeing is things that change during inflation. So we're pretty happy about the red tilt because we think it makes sense with the fact that, you know, we're going down the potential toward the end of inflation. So if in other statistics we see some other kind of scale dependence, we either see some feature along here or we see some generic trend, that's actually helping us to probe sort of the evolution during this long time period here. Okay, right, so usually the other important feature besides this delta function is that people often scale this like some second power of the power spectrum for a good reason. I mean, you can see just from here that that's what you get, and that turns out to be generic. What's that?
Sorry.
Yes, sorry, thanks. Yeah, it's important. And then there's this coefficient FNL, and then there's just some function of these Ks. Some scalar function, dimension 6, but there could be dot products and stuff in there. So the important thing here is basically that this, one of the important things is that this delta function ensures that you're talking about triangles. So you can see that there's a lot more information just because you can have a lot more kinds of triangles than you can have when you're just a function of one momentum. And that also gives rise to something that's called the shape, which is one of the important distinguishing features of these. So different types of interactions give you different shapes, and that's something you can possibly measure. Okay. Yeah, of course. Sorry, this shape lives in here. Yeah, but it's the shape of triangles because of the delta function. That's what I want to say. Yeah. Does that make sense? So for example, sorry, there was okay. So the guys were. Some models, for example, you can easily calculate this model, and it has a very simple form of this function, which is just like the sum of the k's cubed over the product of the k's. And it turns out that this guy prefers or has the largest signal in triangles that are extremely squeezed. So this is sometimes the local triangle or the squeezed triangle. Okay, so you can probably already see that in general, I mean, of course, for this model, I can calculate this and I'm done. But in general, taking this FNL as sort of the parameter characterizing non-Gaussianity is a little bit of an oversimplification. So certainly it's an oversimplification because there's no reason that this expansion stops here. And for realistic models, it probably doesn't. You get more parameters, more terms. It's also oversimplified because it doesn't contain the shape information, because it doesn't contain scale dependence, things like that. So there are a lot more features there that you can put in. And as soon as we moved into this sort of regime of observation where we thought we could actually see non-Gaussianity, and we thought there were models that predicted something of observable size, it became important to actually, you know, do something a little more precise here. Okay. So let me just point out, too, that this paper in particular, which other people in the room were also involved in, is just sort of a nice overview paper. It's one of these, you know, astrophysics white papers that the community puts out to explain to each other why ideas are important and sort of what they think the future direction is. So if you want a really quick summary of all of this, this is a good thing to look at. Okay. A couple other quick features to review. First of all, if I write down here, can you see? Yeah. It's really easy in this ansatz to say what we mean by nearly Gaussian. So I want to give you some sense of what sizes of this FNL actually mean. So if you want this to be nearly Gaussian, which we do because that's what we observe, you can see that if I just compute the 2 point here, there's of course the Gaussian contribution which we want to dominate, and the next term is going to come from this thing squared, essentially. So for this thing, model to be nearly Gaussian, we want this contribution to be small, which basically just says that FNL squared times this P zeta, if I just talk about amplitudes, has to be less than 1, or FNL, putting in the observable number, has to be less than about 10 to the 9 halves. So you can see that being nearly non-Gaussian isn't necessarily FNL being particularly small in this parameterization. The thing is, though, that what we see observationally, again, this is, you know, from the CMB, so this is just this little window that we have, and this is model dependent. So just sort of very roughly, we see that FNL is certainly a number less than about order 100. So we're well within from what we observe, the Gaussian regime, and it, you know, by several orders of magnitude, and that's why people very often say the CMB is very Gaussian, or the fluctuations are very Gaussian, because there's a big difference between what they could be to be nearly Gaussian and what they are. On the other hand, most of the inflation models that you've probably seen for, you know, over the years have been a single field slow roll. Mm-hmm. with various other small caveats, like they're smooth and things like that. And from work a few years ago by Maldacena and Aquaviva et al., we know that FNL in these models is essentially the spectral index, NS minus 1, which we know is a small number. So this is something like 0.04. So again, there's a huge range between what most of the inflation models that people have been writing down over the years predict and what we're currently bounded at. So on the one hand, it's very hard to actually get down to this test, which probably waits for 21 centimeter or something, if even then. On the other hand, there's a huge potential to discover something interesting that's not slow roll and roll out almost all the inflation models that were out there up until about 2 years ago. So this is exciting. And it's doubly exciting because Planck launches next week. Should be able to see deviations up to about, you know, of order 5 or of order a few. So Planck has the potential to really bring this number down to an interesting range. Yeah, I guess if it's very temporarily violating it, you might consider that still to be mostly a slow roll model. So yeah, so mostly what I mean by smooth here is that there aren't any local deviations from slow roll. But yeah. Okay, so those are a few numbers of interest, I think. Okay, so what I want to do, if there's any more sort of basic setup questions, you can please ask now. Well, what I would like to do is go on and actually illustrate some possibilities in a context that maybe you're familiar with, which is brain inflation. Not necessarily because, or certainly not because, we have a perfectly good working model in this context that everybody loves and we all agree is great, but because it just happens to have most of the features that are useful for illustrating deviations from this sort of simple local ansatz, and sort of historically it served as one of the pushes to the community to look at more interesting ideas. Remind you of sort of the very basic picture of this is that we have some cool octopus shape compactification part we're sort of interested in because it seemed to be the most reasonable at various moments for giving enough inflation. It could be some sort of warped throat. And we look at the motion of a D brain, D3 brain, by brain, something more complicated. Yes, sorry. Yeah. Thanks. Some sort of brain's motion in this warp space. And if there's a D3 bar here, we have all kinds of fun stuff like a nice end of inflation and cosmic strings and all of that. So in some sense, this model has a lot of nice, fun features, although it's hard to make it work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write a very simplified version of the DBI action in sort of a weird form, and then explain why I'm doing that. So let me try and see if you like it or not. So I'm pretty much just assuming that this thing is what I want for inflation. So I'm just getting the scale factor here. Is a couple things. First, I'm saying that the inflaton field is related to the position of the brain. So this doesn't, you know, a lot of the stuff that I'm going to write here for the string theory doesn't actually matter because I'm perfectly allowed to take some action of this type for inflation, you know, regardless. But just in case you want to orient yourself, I'm relating in principle the scalar field to the position of the brain by something like the tension. And this quantity that I've written as n to the 4th is really the warp string scale, essentially, to the 4, because it's the brain tension what is the word factor? And X, X I have to define. X I'm using as a shorthand for the kinetic energy. And the reason for doing that is, of course, it's a shorthand, but also it's sort of related to these models where all of this would be called P of X and phi, and that's, you know, either the K inflation of Mukhanov and people like that. It's just sort of a more generic form of the X. So this stuff like this was talked about by people like Mukhanov and collaborators for a long time, but in a different context. And the case that brought this to the attention of a lot of cosmologists because of the non-Gaussianity was, of course, Eva and collaborators. That really pointed out some of the interesting features of this particular case of this type of action. So I could spend, and over the past 5 years or so, there could have been probably a different one-hour talk every 6 months related to working out what the heck this thing is and what its features are and how we calculate it, things like that. And that's great and that's important, but at the end of the day, you know, what you need from this are those numbers. And basically the number of e-folds, and that's the one that turns out to be kind of hard. Unfortunately, once you achieve those things, a lot of the details of what you've done end up getting lost. So, you know, this is sort of a key feature to actually making string theory models that work. But what's kind of cool about this example is, if you work hard enough at doing that, and you think you have this form of the kinetic term, you get a whole bunch of interesting signals out that aren't particularly sensitive to some of the details. So I'm going to focus on this part, although there's tons of interesting stuff here. Okay, let me just make sure I'm not forgetting anything. Okay, so there's a few interesting things here, and what I want to do basically is list for you, maybe over here, the features that I want to keep for the point where we get to observations. So the first feature is that you can see that I've made one obvious simplification here, which is that I only have one field, right? I only have the radial position of the brain. So one thing that's nice about this model is it's sort of naturally a multi-field model. And that's fun because you get a lot of interesting signatures from that, either during inflation or at the end of inflation if the fields change how inflation ends. So that's one of the things that's potentially observable. So let me just put that there and leave it be for the moment. The thing that's important for non-Gaussianity is that there's basically one parameter here that you need to talk about how observables change. And that just comes from this new type of kinetic term. And so this is the sound speed. In this case, it's one in the case where you have a standard kinetic term and it gets small as you deviate from that. So what this does physically is it just gives you a sound horizon for the fluctuations. So instead of having fluctuations that freeze out when they see the Hubble scale horizon, they freeze out when they see that modified by a factor of the sound speed. So and to a large extent, you can just forget about details and just talk about how things behave with sound speed. And the important one in particular is that FNL is like 1 over CS squared. So for a small sound speed, a really big deviation, you get a large FNL. So that's the second interesting point here. So first of all, this is a distinct kind of interaction for multiple fields, and it seems like it can give FNL, you know, at least an order something very interesting to observe. Okay. The one thing I want to point out is that this form where it's summed into a square root is interesting, right? So for a little while there was discussion about sort of building an effective field theory of inflation. And one of the things that people pointed out is, well, if I start thinking I'm doing an expansion where I'm only allowed to keep a few terms, so this thing is really small, then I really only get FNL of order 1 or something. So you need some interesting form of these terms to get a large answer. So that was interesting.
You also need to find the sound depends on phi, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah, but basically. Yeah, but even if it, I guess you could say even if it wasn't phi dependent, if you just had the, something that M was actually, instead of being of order M Planck, you know, it was something more comparable to H, closer to H than to M Planck, you would have a large effect, right?
Well, that's also true.
Yeah.
But that would be a very different theory.
Yeah, sure. But sort of if you just took this by itself and said, what is M such that it's interesting? Okay. Yeah, so the next feature is exactly the one that Eva is just mentioning, which is the scale dependence. So not only is this M, you know, not M Planck in its M string scale, in this case it's actually changing with position here. So because, again, remember position corresponds to scale, basically you get an FNL which you can write as some, you know, FNL at some scale. Same thing we did before. And pull out how it changes with scale. And here, you know, in principle, if this was the model you wrote down, you can just calculate what this is and find some range of parameters, you know, for its size.
What's the subscript on the end?
Oh, and NG for non-Gaussian instead of NS, whatever. Yeah.
Are you saying that square root form does give you a large slope of small values instead of square values?
Yeah. So I'm saying, yeah, if I had done this, then I would have an expansion here, which gives me something like FNL of order 1 or 2. But
right, it doesn't have to. It depends on the solution.
Well, but it does.
Right. So you can find solutions where the square root gives you a large non-Gaussian, and you can find solutions where it
doesn't. Sure. So in the sense that you really need to solve for the equation of motion, but
what's the P, I guess, in the form of CS? Is that the same P as up above it?
Yeah, it's this whole thing. So this is the thing that you want to take the derivative of.
So what do you write as a solution? It's just a Lagrange.
But the thing
depends on the V of phi and the precise so that you take on the V of phi.
The thing that matters is this quantity, right? How large x is.
You say when that is large.
Yeah, if this is close to 1, you need to keep the whole square root. But this, of course, is really, you know, x is, there's some classical solution for this thing, right? Which depends on the potential. And so if you can be in a regime where that whole square root doesn't matter. But on the other hand, if you think you have reason to believe it's there, then you're allowed to go closer to this point and get a large answer. Yeah, that's right. If you call this thing gamma, then it's 1 over gamma. Okay. So in fact, you can do something a little bit more general, which is to ask how the endpoint correlation behaves, because we know that essentially the two-point goes like p zeta squared, but over this factor of CS now, which is interesting because that's what gives you this large FNL. So the in general, these functions actually behave this way. Which is interesting. First, it's interesting because this kind of behavior where the endpoint function goes like the two-point function to some power is something cosmologists like, because that's what happens sort of in gravity. So this is something they call hierarchical, and it comes out of the local ansatz because that was sort of built to resemble gravity. So it's a very nice feature. It's a very natural feature from the point of view of this particle physics model, but it's also nice for translating between various kinds of statistics, so hierarchical. The only difference is that there are these factors of CS, which is a small parameter in principle, which sits in the denominator here, so that makes it look a lot different than the hierarchical model without that small parameter. And you might wonder, in that case, if you can take CS to be, you know, very small and still have a well-behaved theory. Because it looks like, in principle over here, the things that are controlling how small this gets are basically, you know, how small the warping is at the bottom of the throat, how small this M can get, which seems to be something different than what's controlling H, which is, you know, a variety of other things, but including some parameters that actually live maybe up here. So if you're interested in this ratio H over M, you can imagine that you actually don't want to be in the case where it's even in a sort of, you know, simple sense where it's strongly coupled in the sense that H lives below there, or above there. So you can ask what that means for the CS, and it turns out you can write it in a really simple way. So just by checking that corrections to the two-point function aren't large from these interactions, you can show that you need CS to the 4 to be greater than this P zeta, this 10 to the 9, minus 9, okay? And so this is actually more general. So you can actually show the same bound either from looking at sort of an EFT for fluctuations, which was done by Chung et al., or by trying to look at an EFT for the inflaton. And the only difference between these things really is that, you know, this sort of reorganizes the information, because you can see that there are lots of terms that you might write down in the expansion for the inflaton that all contribute to the 3-point of fluctuations, because you're going to have contributions from, you know, basically every term here that has more than 3 powers of the field to the 3-point, things like that. So this is a reorganization question, but it's nice that you get the same answer. So at least if you want to, you know, if you think you can do the whole range of that potential that I wrote down in one calculation, you don't expect the sound speed to grow too large. So in that sense, FNL is bounded, and you can see it's exactly essentially the same bound that we had before, because this goes like 1 over FNL squared. So it fits exactly what you expect from the local ansatz too. Okay. And the last thing, which is sort of a minor point, but that's nice, is that of course there is consistency with other observables. So that your spectral index, which was always a function of these slow roll parameters, epsilon and eta, now also depends on this n and g, and the sound speed shows up everywhere, for example, in the tensor scalar ratio. So this is the ratio of power and tensor modes over power and scalar modes. So, you know, if you think you have this model, besides all the detailed checks of sort of the shape and everything you can do, you can also just check that it's consistent with what you observe for these things. Okay. So now, at the risk of really boring you all, what I want to try to explain is that sort of the range of observations that people can do, that people are interested in right now, and why they like input from those from theory that tells about those kind of concepts I wrote down on that side. So first of all, let me start with the idea that there are sort of two classes of observables for this stuff. There are two broad classes. And one of them is kind of the obvious thing, that you expect, you know, to see no 3-point if it's Gaussian, and you expect to see a 3-point if it's non-Gaussian. So you can just go ahead and measure the individual correlation functions. So you can look for the bispectrum, or you can look for in the CMB, you can look at the power spectrum, and bispectrum. Of galaxies, for example. And this is great if you have a very particular model. So if I gave you DBI inflation and I computed for you the 3-point, you can run it through and compare it to data. If I gave you the local ansatz and I gave you the 3-point, you can go through and compare it to the data. And even that is not completely, you know, trivial in the sense that it's hard work to get the right a form that's numerically easy to compare. What's hard, though, is that it's not possible, at least at the moment, to go through, for example, the CMB and calculate every conceivable triangle that there is, and for them to tell us which type of triangle is maximized. So to give us some sort of form, you know, experimental form for the bispectrum, that's sort of too hard of a calculation.
What's the bispectrum?
Sorry, yeah, the bispectrum is the same as the 3-point. It's bi because it depends on two momenta. So usually 3-point is real space and bispectrum is momenta space. Yeah, sorry. So it's both a good and a bad type of statistic, and it rapidly becomes hard. You might imagine that you could measure sort of the four-point or the trispectrum, but beyond that, you think it's probably too small. The other thing that you can do is just essentially do anything else. So there are all kinds of other statistics that aren't just individual correlation functions that you could check. And this includes things like sort of morphological properties of the... of the temperature map. Same. Which goes by the name of Minkowski functionals. Or sort of an analog for large-scale structure would be to count the number of very large objects, so to count the number of galaxy clusters.
But isn't the first one just a weaker version of number one? I mean, is there no ranking
in number two compared to number one?
Well, with galaxy, yeah, well, I guess. What do you mean about Minkowski functionals, and is it more information than you get from doing the sort of optimized estimator in the CNN?
It's just different information. So both the Minkowski functionals and the galaxy clusters, in principle, depend on not just the three-point, right? They depend on some combination of higher correlation functions. So if
those are not...
Yeah, if you have a nice simple behavior like most of these models have, most likely you think the three-point is the most important thing, and you're not getting necessarily any new information except to confirm that the three-point was the most important thing. So for most reasonable models that we write down, we think that makes sense. If you're just looking for something that's evidence of non-Gaussianity, and maybe, you know, I think, for example, cosmic strings don't exactly behave like that, although probably they still have a nice... you know, systematic expansion in the correlation functions, but they don't have exactly the same power scaling with the two-point. If you're looking for something else, something different, you might think that looking at these is gonna pull out for you a non-Gaussian signal if it's not exactly this kind of thing that you like. The other advantage, I guess, is that essentially it just depends on in different ways on the data. So, you know, for example, the bispectrum of galaxies is really great at pulling out the squeeze limit. The galaxy clusters operate at a different, you know, a slightly smaller scale, and they're better at pulling out the equilateral type or something like that. So you sort of want to be able to cross-correlate and, you know, measure the Minkowski functional and verify that when you take this translation, you know, based on assuming this particular form of correlation functions from the local model, you get exactly what you get by actually measuring the local model bispectrum in the temperature.
So compared to the CMB, which is primordial to a good approximation, I mean, it seems like you have to make a lot of assumptions about other cosmology and nonlinear evolution to use galaxy surveys to learn about inflation. So, I mean, how much other information is involved in there that you're just assuming?
So, actually, not too terribly much, at least for some particular statistics. So, the idea is that you try to choose things that, first of all, are linear in the gravitational evolution, so you don't have to do a lot of higher order corrections. You look at things where, you know, that aren't particularly sensitive to dark matter, things like that. There's certainly still, you know, a lot of potential there for error, but it's pretty well quantified. And what it looks like at the moment is that this, at least for the local model, the bispectrum of galaxies can give you comparable estimates to what you can get from the CMB. And depending on what you believe, for galaxy clusters, you might be able to get something that's a little bit worse, but it does operate at a smaller scale. So, yeah, basically, you can go on forever about gas surveys, but...
So the galaxy surveys themselves can get down to 4 to 5 or something.
Right. So at the moment, the bound is comparable to the CMB bound, and the idea is that in the future, the bound will actually go down, as it will for Planck. Yeah. Yeah. I have the exact bound. But... Yeah. So maybe let me just write. So for this, if you use this technique, for example, you get something like -4. What's interesting is that if you use this for FNL local, you seem to get something like, it actually sits at a negative value, so it's 54 and 60. So these things aren't in exact agreement right now, which is kind of interesting. And if you use the five spectrum, you get minus 57. So the only difference is that this is basically for K less than 0.2. So that's a little bit lower in terms of K, but it's comparable size.
Isn't it so for the galaxies, up in the local, the central value is not so
positive? Yeah, slightly less, although it's still.
I mean, there was that room.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So let me maybe just. Maybe say a little bit more about this one because it's kind of interesting. So what I wrote down for Gaussian or non-Gaussian so far was a series of correlation functions, which is, you know, a good way to quantify it. The other thing you could do, sort of the most naive thing you could do, is write down, just draw the probability distribution for, say, delta rho over rho. And of course I can't really draw a Gaussian. But suppose that's it. And then suppose I have something that's non-Gaussian. So this thing is a positively skewed distribution. So it has FNL positive, actually. And what that means for structure is just that very large galaxy clusters are formed from several sigma fluctuations, positive fluctuations. So to some extent, the amount of structure is sensitive to this tail. So if you have FNL positive from your primordial model, you expect to see more very large cold spots in the CMB, or you expect to see more galaxy clusters.
So with the galaxies, there's some scale beyond which things are basically, there's no non-linearities coming from the gravitational dynamics itself.
And yeah.
As much, I mean, presume that something has to be folded out.
Yeah, so let me, actually I can draw that picture too. I can fit it here, let me do it here. So let's make this the CMB scale, so like 0.001, which is a scale in inverse megaparsecs. So the CMB, if you go out to L of something like 500, which is, you know, what WMAP does, Planck will go further. CMB is somewhere here. Let me call this FNL. So CMB bounds are something like this region here. When you look at galaxy bispectrum, or to some, the analysis that's done here for galaxy power spectrum is really a very simplified version. It's not really computing, galaxies with full collapse and baryons falling in and all of that. It's sort of a simplification about, you know, small clumps of dark matter on top of large dark matter clumps. So it actually doesn't need a whole lot of detailed astrophysics. And that can operate on essentially scales here. So in terms of the galaxy bispectrum, this is really distances between galaxies. So it doesn't have to do with the detailed collapse of galaxies or anything like that. So this is the bispectrum. And then clusters, because now we're talking about the size of the cluster as the relevant scale, but because it's sort of the largest object where you can assume it sort of just started to collapse, you don't have to do the detailed nonlinearity evolution. But you can still get down a little farther, sort of into this regime. So this is really the size of the cluster. So these are things of like 10 to 15 solar masses, something like that. And it's that thing that sets the scale R that you're mostly interested in. And this is sort of distance between. So the constraints we have on the local model come from, fall into this regime pretty well. And constraints we have on equilateral are just sit here and here. Of course, the CMB, you know, with Planck, the CMB is going to have quite a large range just by itself. And in principle, the data should be good enough that you could go through and actually check scale dependence just within that data set, which would be great, or look for, you know, maybe sort of localized features or something. But even so, you can sort of extend and check the consistency of your observations by using stuff that lives out here. Okay.
So what are your current estimates on how well you can do clusters given the...
So if you assume our current ability to measure the amplitude of fluctuations on sort of 8 megaparsec scales, and our current ability to constrain the cluster mass, which is only to a factor of about 10%, then it seems like you can pick out, if you just want to do FNL and you assume that everything's constant, you can get FNL not particularly good, but maybe a little bit better than 100. If you want to do FNL together with scale dependence, you either need FNL that's somewhat larger than this, or you need, you know, to have an NNG that's in the 0.5 range or something like that. So you can just use a pinpoint at the CMP scale together with this. But because you're introducing new parameters, it doesn't look particularly good. But the hope, I think, the claim is that that's, you know, how well we do with cluster mass is definitely going to improve. How well we do with sigma 8 is definitely going to improve. So
you guys have done this with existing...
So that's still in progress, which actually Steve Allen's group. So that's still something that's coming, but you can just sort of estimate based on the size of surveys how well you think you can do. But those guys actually have done a great job at sort of, you know, decreasing some of the uncertainties or parameterizing the uncertainties of what the cluster mass is. So I think the hope is that with that, you can actually do something interesting. Okay. Yeah, anything else about that? Yeah, I guess the only other point that I wanted to make is for things like this, which I just sort of made already, for comparing statistics like this comparison of FNL local, for example, from these three different types of measurements, it's good if you can assume that you understand the behavior of this thing, because all of the estimates of Minkowski functionals are based on making, you know, a particular expansion that works for the local model. And it's interesting that the numbers don't exactly agree, and what that's a symptom of, nobody knows yet. Probably it's a symptom of the fact that this is maybe a little bit harder calculation to do at the moment. We don't know. Okay, so maybe what I can do is just finish by summarizing for you what each of these things translates into, or sort of what are the things to watch in terms of observations. So, you know, multiple fields versus derivatives, things like that, essentially get folded into this shape, which I didn't talk about very much, but whether things are largest in these squeezed triangles or these equilateral triangles. And that's something you get by measuring this pi spectrum, which is just the 3-point. The size of FNL, of course, has a huge potential to basically say slow roll, not slow roll. And that's something that Planck can do, so that's a very near future observation. The scale dependence, basically like we talked about, just has to do with looking for sort of trends during inflation or looking for features during inflation. So it's somehow getting you out of this tiny window of CMP. So by features, I just mean anything interesting that happens that's not just a single field with a very flat potential, or trends. So there are a lot of reasons to think that there could be a trend. I mean, certainly at sort of the stupidest level, you know, you're proportional to the spectral index. The spectral index is also slightly changing. So that's something you can measure, but you expect that there could very well be some trend during inflation. There are a couple of existing multi-field models where the trend is given by sort of the translation between the various fields during inflation. There's this trend which of the DBI, which maybe is natural, maybe it's not, but you know that's a trend toward lower energy in some sense. And that's something that you really need the large scale structure data to help you with, or maybe Planck if there's actually something large there. This is a feature which, if you don't see this type of behavior, it's something probably relatively weird, because it seems like this is a nice feature of particle physics models. So maybe I'll just say weird or not weird.
These texture models were different when they were in, but they're out now.
The texture model?
Yeah, because they tend to give spots, which are
Yeah, so that...
I guess they're no longer interested, so...
Well, so maybe you're talking about the sort of renewal of interest in over this very large cold spot or something. Yeah.
They require huge tuning, though, right, to suppress point suppressed operators? Yes, I mean, they were killed by a workshop here, actually. 1992 by Mark Russell Hall and Kenny Kowski Hall.
Wait, did they have the right to scouse in workshop?
Well, what they pointed out is that the global symmetry to make the texture stable over long enough time scales to be relevant for structure, there would be a large series of Planck suppressed operators that had to have really, really tiny coefficients. So, I mean, as an idea, I think they were killed. I don't know about the data.
But I mean, did they have super horizon perturbations and the usual acoustic peak structure?
I'm not sure.
I mean, that's...
But I guess the point is that even if you're not using them as your primary formation of structure for reasons like this, if you have some remnant left over, you can get an additional non-Gaussian piece that might be large compared to the primordial non-Gaussian piece.
And did anyone get damage for cosmic string, especially down the room? You know, they could give us the
Yeah, so there about a year ago, I was at a workshop in Cambridge where the usual people were representing results of simulations and stuff, but I didn't see it actually get published. So they're working on it, and this is sort of where the discussion was about that it doesn't behave in quite the same way as the particle physics, and possibly the 4-point is more interesting than the 3-point because of symmetry reasons or something like that.
And what shape
would they be? So I don't think they didn't have a shape, but they had a slight tendency toward negative FNL, I think, and they had some evidence that the 4-point should be large just by some symmetry argument comparable to the 2-point, and that the scaling was not with the second power of the 2-point, but with the 3 power or something like that. So, but none of that ever came up, so I don't want to know. I'm recorded, of course, but sorry. But in principle, I think they're working on it.
There wasn't a claim also in sound, small sound sleep, that the 4-point might be not bigger, but at least observable first, instead of the bispectrum, that the trispectrum might be easier to pick up, because even though it's hierarchical, you have the water resource that increase the trispectrum.
Claim that it's easier to pick up, though?
It's not darn good at all, pulse upon that claim.
Not ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so just experiment, like...
No, there was a flaw in the theory.
Okay, and then this is sort of just a point about, you know, if you hand off something to the Ramona's friends to fit, you know, and you give it increasing non-Gaussianity, you probably don't want it to increase out of control, and claim that you're going to see something that's too large, because that doesn't actually make sense. Okay, and then maybe I should just say also here that this is good to compare various statistics. Okay. So, let me summarize. About all the particulars of observations, I think the main point is just that cosmology and string theory have had a pretty good relationship so far. And there's pretty remarkable potential for that quality relationship to continue and to actually get something worthwhile out. So probably one of our best bets for seeing something that's really evidence of high-energy physics is going to be here. And this is particularly great because really, let me just emphasize again, being able to really pick out the details of non-Gaussianity is really being able to look at the fundamental physics of the implosion. You know, if you're really not a believer so far in inflation, that's fine, because you can argue that in some sense, you know, all we need to do is get some expanding or contracting phase and some way of generating, you know, this spectrum of acoustic peaks, which maybe doesn't necessarily mean that we have inflation. If we start seeing a couple of other things, for, you know, especially primordial gravitational waves, or if we really can pick out with some good evidence that we understand what particular physics might be driving the particular interactions that we see, that goes a long way toward actually, you know, giving inflation, putting inflation on really solid ground. So that's important. Since the observations are now, the theory input is really needed now. So any ideas for new models in string theory that are fully consistent, or any ideas for interesting features that we might go see in these three-point interactions, now's the time, because the next few years we're going to see the data. So in other words, things to watch are Planck. First, watch to make sure that it doesn't blow up. And watch to see what the results are. And
we have a watch countdown, right?
Yeah, exactly. You can watch by the second right now. But the time is actually given right now in like New Guinea. It's the French Guiana time, so I'm not sure what that translates into. But they have the watch time written in a time zone that I don't know what it is. We can have it. That'd be fun. At least to some extent, it's good to pay attention to what cosmologists are doing in terms of gathering this data about galaxies, because it actually is relevant to what we're doing, and it's not so hard to calculate what the effects of this fundamental stuff is for the galaxies and the structure. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks.
Sorry, probably a naive question. Is just from the fact that the graviton has self-interactions, does that put a theoretical lower bound on this FNN?
Well, actually, the term that I wrote down from the slow roll model, the dominant term is actually coming from a gravitational term, not from the sort of the self-interaction, the potential. So, I mean,
that's sort of
yeah. Well,
your quantum was order 0.01.
Yeah. So in addition, though, what you have is our sort of evolution. So that was just the primordial thing from that early interaction, but you have evolution during inflation and after inflation, gravitational evolution, which is what gives us one.
So we have to see something if we get to that center.
Exactly. And that's why people are really excited by these sort of wild claims about 21 centimeter, because you absolutely have to see the gravitational part that's even bigger for large scale structure, and then in principle you could pull out of that the part you absolutely have to see, from inflation.
People are really doing non-linearities in the surface of last scattering, finding contributions.
It's
getting very sensitive.
Some people are saying in a way that it's a very good test of GR in a way, because,
it's more than GR, just the plasma system.
Exactly. All of that.
So is this something which is happening or will be done?
It'll be done, but how much it'll be in this
one? But how much you're going to disentangle from...
How much primordial it is. I mean, it's a study of reionization, first of all, in the first stars, right?
TS is something these days, right? But...
Is there a time scale, or is it just essentially training data?
No, I mean, I think they certainly are starting to build... I mean, they have a prototype of various types of constructions of satellite configurations that they think configurations that they think are going to pull out a good signal. So at least prototypes are being built, and I think they have sites and everything picked out for the real thing. So I think it's going forward for sure. Yeah, which is really cool. I think because of the fact that it's so cheap, right? People are going to do it.
Is there a reasonably general calculation of your function big F of the 3Ks for multi-field models? Is somebody trying to do that?
Yeah.
It seems like that's a very queen theory thing that ought to be done that doesn't depend on any assumption.
Yeah, so... Well, the
You have to do particle
projection
as well as this one.
Yeah, the last stuff I heard about a year ago at this workshop, so I think...
Thank you.